My name is Anna Marie Clifton. I'm a product manager at Yammer, and I'm here to talk to you about all the ways that A/B testing sucks. Quick show of hands before we get started. How many of you are working in product currently? And how many of you are working in an environment where you're running A/B tests? Okay, all right, so a good number of you have some background, some experience in this. This is great. Before I get started, let me talk to you a little bit about the way it normally goes at talks like this and how this is gonna be different. So normally at a talk to people who are in product or at a technology conference, people will start with something that they weren't doing well, and then they'll go through how they learned to do it better. And in the end, you'll end up with a great tidbit on like how it should be done and kind of an ideal world. They might share some hiccups along the way or some war stories that they've experienced. But usually in the end, you're going to end up in a pretty sweet spot. And that's not really where I plan to leave you tonight. I think that does a disservice to product managers specifically and especially, because as product managers, our job is to defeat ambiguity, to find where that boundary is, where the unknown meets the known, and then take that information at the fringes and organize it into some coherent narrative that makes it easier for our teams to move faster. So I really think that trying to sell you on exactly how to run A/B testing and how to do it in an ideal situation and how it's gonna serve you so well actually will do a disservice to you. So a little bit of background on me. So I'm a product manager at Yammer. I've been there for a little bit over a year. Before I was at Yammer, I worked at Asana. Before that, I did some smaller startups. And then way back in the day, I managed an art gallery in New York. So I have a completely different background into product, like many of you. I saw it from the outside and decided that it's something that I wanted to be in and worked very hard in a very circuitous way to get into product. You can find me online. I do a lot of writing and tweeting at Tweet Anna Marie. I publish on Medium. And then also I have a podcast, the Clearly Product Book Club podcast, Stitcher and iTunes, you can find that. I publish about once a month and I talk about some book that's relevant to a skill in product management. So a little bit of our roadmap today. I'm gonna take you through the rosy side of A/B testing for all of you who are not in environments where you're doing that right now. I just wanna level that playing field so everyone understands what we're talking about. And then we'll go through the gray side of A/B testing and some of those dark valleys. And in the end, we'll meet you somewhere in the middle and see what we can learn. So let's start with the rosy side of A/B testing. So what is it? Surprisingly enough, I talk to a lot of aspiring product managers who think that A/B testing is taking an experience, creating a new one, giving that to all of your users, and then checking and see what happens afterwards. And that's just completely not. So that's sequential testing, and you maybe not, can't even call it testing. That's when you A/B test something, it's imperative that you test it at the same time. So an A/B test is where you'll take an experience, you'll create a comparable experience, and you'll launch that to 50% of your users. So you have your treatment group, 50%, and your control group, 50%. Almost always you'll do a 50-50 test. For those of you who haven't done A/B testing, you're almost always just gonna be testing two variants. And then you wanna watch which metrics move over time and establish which one you think was the winner. And then that one becomes the one experience at the end. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about why to not do a sequential test and why it's different, why A/B testing is better. So we'll take an example of a new signup flow. So say you have a signup flow, your experiences in the product right now, about 80% of your users are completing that signup flow. They start at the beginning, they go through maybe 5-6 steps, they finish. 20% along the way fall off. And so your head of product says, hey, you know, Anna Marie, what can you do to make this better? Can you design an experience where 90% of users are gonna get to the end and sign up successfully? So you release a new flow to all of your users. In a sequential testing world, you'd say, here, I took out a step and I released this new signup flow and I expect that users are gonna be signing up way more often. We're gonna get 90% of people all the way through the funnel. And then you measure again, now that you've released this experience to everyone. And now only 70% are completing. Sad cat. Womp womp. So that looks disastrous. Your head of product is very upset. You're concerned about losing your job. You're staying up late at night chewing your fingernails. That's terrifying, but it might not necessarily be your fault, and it might not necessarily be a bad experience. So now I'm going to walk you through the new sign-up experience if you had run it as an A-B test. So again, you have 80% of your users are completing a sign-up flow. That's your base state. That's your control. So now you release a new flow to 50% of your users, and this is your treatment. So you have your control, who are completing at about 80%, and your treatment. And you want to test how they compare against each other. Well, 70% of your users in treatment are completing. Like we said in that previous experience, you have a 70% throughput. But it turns out that during those few weeks while you were running this test, only 60% of the control users were completing. So maybe there was some famine, or it was Easter weekend, or there's some holiday in another country that has a really strong user base for your product that you weren't aware of that holiday. So it's not necessarily apparent unless you're testing against the same time frame if your experience is better or worse. So this is the benefit of A/B testing. It feels really delightful at the end of a test when you get to say that this one's better and you can point at that. You're going to spend so much time in your day and so many days in your week dealing with two designers that have opposing opinions, or trying to trade technical debt against product debt, trying to make your head of product and your head of engineering equally happy. And you're constantly going to be at the crux of trade-offs that end up with everyone upset. You're not going to have right answers in your job a lot of the time. And A/B testing, when it comes back at the end and it's very clear and apparent, is one of those glorious golden experiences where you just get to like lay off all of that weight and know that you did something right. And that's a rare thing in product management. But that's not always the case. So that's the rosy side. Now I want to spend some time digging into a lot of different ways that it sucks. I'm going to talk a little bit about this from the engineering side as well as the product side. So from an engineering perspective, it takes longer to build a test than it does to just ship code. So this is pretty easy to think about. It's pretty easy to rationalize about. If you need to build an experience that works as well as a control experience, it just takes a little bit longer as opposed to just building something and shipping it wholesale. It's a little bit rough. Time is money, and especially in the startup world, time is a lot of money. This one's a lot bigger. You can't make changes in flight. So this comes true in a few different ways on web, and then even more ways on mobile. So on web, if you find a bug in the experience and you want to fix that bug, you might have to turn off the experience and then restart the test. You can't necessarily fix something that's unrelated that's in that same area of the product because it'll fundamentally affect the way that users are engaging in that area of the product. And if you're trying to get unbiased data while you're doing that, you might just have to sit out and wait for something that's a little bit unfortunate. It's very difficult to address open wounds in your product that you find out about if there's a test going on in that space at the time. And it's disastrous on mobile. So if you have released an experiment on mobile and you find a bug that's like, it might not even be breaking the experiment. It might just be a negative user experience. But if it's negative enough, the steps that you have to take are first, turn off the experiment, fix the bug, release the experiment under a new experiment key so you can re-enroll users, wait for the app stores to approve your build, then wait for all the users to download the new app because they have to get that new code installed, especially if you've done something like break an API or something like that and you absolutely have to do that. Even in cases where the bug itself only takes a day to fix, that can take weeks to roll back, reset, and start over. And that's not even the worst part. The worst part is your users during this time have been in control, and then in the A/B test, and then back to control, and then maybe some of those users are back in the A/B test, but others are still in control, and everyone has no idea what the experience is supposed to be. And if it's a dramatic change of experience, this can be dramatically thrashy for your users. It creates confusion about what is the expected experience. And this goes back to bug triaging again. When you have engineers and a large enough team that aren't all aware of what's happening, or maybe they're not the only one building what's happening, if a bug report comes in, it's difficult to know, is this expected behavior or is this a bug? Is this expected behavior or is this a test, perhaps? And you can't necessarily stay on top of communication flow around that. This is a bit of a hidden trick, because we have over 100 engineers working on different projects at different times. And you can't necessarily keep up with what all they're working on and what's the expected experience. Even the product managers that are working across several areas have difficulty digging into something and trying to figure out if that's an active experiment that's causing that bug, or maybe it's another experiment that wasn't necessarily cleaned up very well. Which, hi, Fernando, leads me to my next point, which is that code cleanup isn't always perfect. So once you've determined which the winning side of the experiment is, you want to turn that side up to 100%. If the experiment wins, you want all your users to have that. And then you have to clean up the old experience. You have to make this the path through the code base. You have to make that the one that the APIs all know to call. Or if it's the existing experience that wins, you have to like remove all the experiment code and pull that out and remove that experience. And that doesn't always happen perfectly. And one of the main reasons for that is, while the A/B test is on, what are your engineers doing? They're not sitting around waiting for data points to accrue. They're working on other things. So once you've called the experiment, you have to call your engineers back to clean up the code. And by that time, they're working on other things. They're in the middle of other contexts. They're definitely not thinking about where all they put all those different parts of that experience. And sometimes you'll end up with code cruft that lasts through for years after an experiment. So that's a number of the issues on the engineering side. Now, the problems that I experience. On the product side, problem number one, it can take forever. So there's a few reasons for this. Number one, one of the main metrics that you're usually going to want to measure is retention. And tautologically speaking, it takes a long while to see how people behave after a long while. Hopefully your data scientists will have defined a metric that they think is highly correlated with long-term retention, and you can measure for that metric early on instead of looking for longer-term retention. But generally speaking, retention is the best indicator of retention. And so you want to at least give yourselves a couple weeks to look and see how you're affecting retention. Correlated with that is the novelty effect. Users don't like change. They sometimes will react really negatively to something being a little bit different. Also, sometimes they'll react really dramatically to something that's like new and blinking at them. So a lot of times, you want to take the data from the first few days or maybe even up to a week of the experiment and discount it altogether. If you have a blinking new light in the top corner of your app that says, click me, click me, click me, click me, a lot of users are going to click that. But then if what they find there that you've added gives them no value, they're not necessarily going to stick around long term. So you want to definitely discount anything that has a strong impetus for a novelty effect. This is particularly true of notification features. So if you're sending a new email or if you've added a new push notification, a lot of times people will respond to that and they'll come into the product or they'll respond to that push, but you don't necessarily want to use just coming into the product as a gauge of success. You want to see, like, did you drive value further down the funnel or did they just respond to that push? So what you want to usually do is throw out the day that you sent that push and then look at how did their retention or other deeper metrics look after the fact. So you got to throw away a lot of data. Also, I'm not a stats major. I am woefully negligent in some of those areas, but a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me have determined how many users you need before you can consider something significant. And it's a lot. You need a lot of users. And that can take a while to accrue those, especially depending on where you've put your experiment, if it's very deep in the product or if it's something really top level, like a landing page. So, needing tons of users. Right now, I have a project I just kicked off with our Android team for something that's kind of buried a little bit deep in our product. And we only have about 31,000 users within a period of a month that engage with that feature. So if I want to be able to A/B test that, I'm going to have to run that for an entire month, more or less, If I'll have 15,000 users on each side of the treatment, and I'll hopefully be able to detect some significant changes. But at that scale, I'll really only be able to detect things if they're pretty dramatic. And dramatic changes tend to not happen in really mature products very easily. So Yammer's been around for quite some time. I think 2008 is the first commit for the code base. And we have a really well-established product. So we're constantly testing and trying to build something better and move towards a better product. But in the end, any individual feature that we launch is only going to have a small impact on actual user behavior. And we're just like moving those little bit forward. So if you don't have enough users, you're not going to be able to detect the size of your impact. So I can briefly touch on how many users you'll need for those of you who haven't worked in this experience. It depends. It depends on a lot of factors. It depends on what you're trying to measure, what metric you want to measure, and what the base rate for that metric is. So if I have a metric that I want to measure that on average only about 3% of my users take that action that are there, that's going to be harder to measure than a metric where most of my users that see it take that action. So it depends on what your base rate is and then also what your expected lift or change is in that metric. So let's say I have 3% of my users who are taking a particular action on this page and I'm going to make a change that I expect to see a 50% lift. So now instead of 3, I'm going to see, shit, I can't do math on the fly. I should have written that down. So I would expect to see a 50% lift. So 4.5% of my users are going to be doing that. Well, that's actually a huge lift. Like, you wouldn't expect to be able to change someone from the average user from not doing a thing to being able to do a thing. That's a very cheap thing to be able to change. If you want to drive real change in behavior, that takes a lot of work, and you're going to be doing that really slowly. And then the last thing is, it's also going to be about what your risk tolerance is for being wrong, because you're not going to know if you're definitely right. And if you increase your risk tolerance, then you can test with fewer users, which I'll talk about that a little bit more later. It takes a lot of upfront work, and this is something that's not readily apparent. A/B testing is not going to give you an answer to a question you don't ask. So you have to think before you build the test, what is the question that you're trying to ask and why is it important? And that takes a lot of cognitive work from both yourself, your analysts, working with your designers, and even bringing your engineers into that as well. There's a couple reasons for this. First of all, you can't look at any data that you forgot to log, which is a terrifying truth. Data doesn't just like appear. You have to tell your system to log data when people take actions. And that's something that's not necessarily obvious. And you're not always thinking about the fact that if you're adding a new part to the experience, you have to also add logging for that. And then you need to make sure you're adding logging in the particular area and in such a way that you'll be able to ask the specific questions that you intend to ask after the fact. So you have to really think about this experience holistically and what you want to get out of it at the end. And then that determines how to build it at the beginning. And that takes a lot of forethought. The second piece is, it's not going to be able to tell you why someone did something. It's only going to be able to tell you what someone did. And it's your job as a PM to define what why you think you're looking for and which what's will point to that. So this is what gets into hypothesis-driven development, which is the way we do product development at Yammer, where it's the PM's job to establish a hypothesis that says, I think that this thing is going to happen because of this change that I'm making, and we'll be able to tell that this thing is going to happen because of these metrics that are going to change. So this thing is often going to be something like users are going to understand groups better. That's not something that has a metric, right? You have to tie a metric to that. You have to figure out what do I think that metric might be. And so defining that hypothesis up front takes a lot of work, but you're not going to get an answer to why people are doing things if you haven't defined that in the beginning. And then it's a lot of after the fact work too. There's almost never an experience where you get the results back and it's exactly what you expected and everything aligns in a pattern and you can see exactly whether you should ship or kill this thing and then why it all happened. I've had two experiences like that where everything I hypothesized up front and the metrics that I expected to move exactly the way they moved ended up moving precisely that way. And boy, was it like a cup of ice cream. It was just the best experience. But it just doesn't happen like that. Users are strange and they behave in strange ways. And you're going to find metrics that move in ways that you didn't expect, or metrics that you expect to be correlated that end up not being correlated. And it's going to take you a lot of work after the fact to dig down to the base level and establish what happened. The number of weeks that I've spent with analysts trying to establish, is there a bug in the experience? Like, why are people doing that? That makes no sense. Or perhaps our randomization was wrong. Maybe we ended up with more users in our control experience who were better users and were doing more posting before, and so now they're still doing more posting. It takes a lot of work from both yourself as well as your analysts. It's geared towards small optimizations, and that's something I hinted at a little bit earlier when I talked about how long Yammer has been in the world, where we have a really well-established product market fit, and we have tons of users, and so we're at a point where we're working on smaller gains because we've already made a lot of the big gains. And the reason why you get smaller optimizations, there's a couple things. So first of all, you're still only going to get answers to questions that you ask. And any question that you can think to ask is kind of by definition going to be pretty small and scoped. Because if you're defining a question that you're going to ask and you're going to get a definitive answer from your data, it's going to look not too dissimilar from what you already have. So you're not going to find blue sky answers in your A/B test results. You're going to find answers to optimizations that you're trying to make. And that's fine, but it's not going to help you with blue sky stuff. It's also, if you're only doing development that's driven by A/B tests, you're going to leave a lot of those big wins untouched. And there's a lot written about this, and people talk about like driving towards a local optimum. And I think that's a phrase people use when they want to sound smart and they don't actually have any ideas or opinions. But that's okay. This one's really fascinating. If you're working in a product that has any kind of platform aspect or network effect, you can't really test network effects significantly in an A/B fashion. It's really only useful in single player mode. So I'll give you an example. We recently launched the ability to edit your posts in Yammer. Well, you can't exactly A/B test that, because if I'm responding to something that you've written, I have to be able to see the thing that you've written. And if I don't have access to the A/B test variant that has editing, and you do, and you've edited your post, then I'm responding to something that's not there, and the whole experience breaks. So this is really important to think about when you're doing test design, especially as perhaps if you're in an interview and someone's talking with you about how you would test something. Think about if there's network effects and how you would control for that. With Yammer, we do have a nice boundary where there is literally a network boundary, and we have companies that have domains, and we can test like a domain versus another domain. But we don't do that. We certainly don't do that very often. And one of the main reasons for that is you have to have a bunch of users in order to get statistically significant data. And if you are testing at the network level, then you have to have a bunch of networks. And the thing about networks is they have a tendency to be culturally cohesive, and they develop a certain way of behaving that's unique to within that entire network. So it's really difficult to get a random distribution of equally behaving and sized networks. So we tend to not test at the network level. It can't be scientific. For all that we would like it to be, your admins are going to email people and tell them to check out this new feature and here's how to use it. People are going to tweet about experiences. Journalists that find out about your test are going to write an article about it. And generally, you can't do double blinds in this world. You're going to end up in a world where your users are hearing about this from other users. And hopefully that's minimized. And honestly, that's kind of a success case. Like, if you have enough users who are tweeting all about your product and enough users watching that, you're probably really important and people like you a lot. So that's great. But at the same time, it can skew the data and it can make for an unbiased test. And that's no fun, because the whole point of A/B testing is to be scientific. So it has its flaws there. And that's really difficult to emotionally handle, because we do try and be so stoic about it. And then you can be totally wrong. So I mentioned earlier about when I talked about how you need a bunch of users, and that's affected by your risk tolerance. It's because you you actually can't know for 100% that the thing that you saw happened because of what you did. There's almost always a chance that it was totally a fluke. In the scientific community, people accept a risk tolerance margin of about 5%. And people talk a lot about p-values, and they take a p-value of 0.05. And that's the point at which, in the scientific community, people will accept your paper for their journal, hopefully. In the tech world, we tend to accept p-values that approach 0.2, which means that you are calling something statistically significant when there's about a 20% chance that it's totally a fluke and just random chance. So just be careful about what tools you're using. There are a lot of tools off the shelf that are set to default up that way. You can change that threshold. I know Optimizely lets you modify that threshold, which is really great. But you're looking basically at your A/B test results. They're probabilistic. They're pointing you in a direction of what they expect is happening because of what you've done. But in the end, it could actually be wrong, which is kind of terrifying. So I talked a little bit about why you might want to test and walked you through some major issues with testing and ways that it can hurt you. But now I'm going to talk a little bit in the middle. So it totally sucks. It slows you down. It actually adds weeks to your development cycle, and weeks is eons in the startup world. You'll end up in debates with your engineers. You'll be frustrated with your designers. You'll be rolling your eyes with your analysts, and everyone's tearing their hair out. But in the end, you're building for your users, and you can't really hear from them in aggregate without tools like A/B testing. The data that you get at the end of a test is really the voice of your users. It's the chorus of them singing at you. And as much as it could be wrong, and as much as it can't be precisely scientific, it's still actually pretty good. And it's still one of the best tools that we have. So I leave you with only one thing tonight. I really want to impress upon you that it is a tool. It's not a cure. It's a diagnostic tool. And it's only going to be as good as the questions that you bring to it. I see a lot of aspiring PMs who will respond to a challenge when I ask them, well, how do you know that's good? Well, what if that failed? And their response is, oh, I just A/B test it. What are you going to A/B test? Like, well, you're going to A/B test the failure? What does that even mean? Like, that actually means nothing. A/B tests are just your scientific tool to put a hypothesis to the road and see how it stands up. So make sure that you remember to make your hypotheses and to do that cognition and that upfront work, because that's what makes our job so much fun. That's what makes our job so valuable. And that's what makes us a really highly paid workforce in tech right now. It is not easy and it is not cheap, and it requires a lot of upfront work and a lot of after the fact work, but it's definitely worth it in the end. Thanks. Okay, questions. I saw your hand up.
You mentioned when you're separating your answer control and your cohort, right? You might have users, for example, that post more in your control versus your cohort or your univariate. How do you come to terms with accepting the results without knowing if it's just because you randomly got more people of that score in one category?
Yeah, so I'm just going to repeat your question. Because they're recording for posterity. So you're asking about, given the fact that we do know that sometimes you'll end up with a control that has statistically different base behaviors than a treatment on occasion, how do you trust that? So I actually have had this experience. So there's a few ways that you trust that. First of all, you're working in such large numbers that that's very rarely going to happen. So if your randomization is actually random, and you're talking about users in the hundreds of thousands, that's not going to be an issue. It will level out. The rare fluke when that does happen, it's usually because you have very few users. And I did have an experiment that had this issue. You can go back in time and look at that user base and determine if they were very different from each other. So I've done this more than once with an analyst where looking at a test, it's like, that's confusing. One of the first things I think about is there any way that we have just completely different user bases? And so what you can do is literally look back through your log data before you started the test, because we're constantly collecting data, and just cohort it preemptively by users that ended up in each segment, and then look and see if there's a statistical difference in how they behave. And then one time I did find a statistical difference. That was the only time. Other times, like, well, that's not the case. The randomization was pure because we're seeing they're behaving the same way. Yeah.
My name is Connie, and you know how, like, as a product manager, when everything goes right, they celebrate, and everything goes wrong, you get blamed. And, like, how do you get comfortable with such possibility of, like, going wrong? Like, you know, like, there's so many possibilities of going wrong, and, like, how do you get comfortable with it, and, like, how would you know that it's sometimes your fault, or, like, is it just, like, random, or, like, when did you step out and take responsibilities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so your question is around how do you develop comfort with all the ambiguity and all the risk and all the chance that you're wrong and you're going to get a lot of the blame sometimes. So how do you, like, develop enough comfort that you can move forward? It's experience. It's failing and then watching yourself not get fired. And then it's failing again and watching yourself not get fired again. I remember talking to my boss's boss about this, the director of product, about 3 or 4 months after I started at Yammer. And I remember being like, oh, I'm just so scared I'm going to get fired all the time. I'm like always afraid that I'm messing something up. And he's like, oh, it took me about a year when I first started before I didn't think I was going to get fired every day. So I think as product managers, we have a tendency to, there's like a selection bias for us to be a little bit more risk tolerant and to kind of deal with that. I would encourage you to do two things. I would encourage you to, like, think about all the times you failed and how bad it actually was. So it's usually worse in your mind than it was in reality. And then also look for other people who have failed and how they're still doing, because, like, no one's in jail for, like, messing up an A/B test, right? So you will fail, and, like, you need to own that. And I have had my share of failures. I could do a whole other talk on, like, all the different ways that I messed up an A/B test. Maybe a short talk. But you have to come to terms with that, and that will help you figure it out. I know one of the best things that I've had is mentors who have outlined exactly, like, what is an acceptable fail box. And, like, within what parameters is it okay to mess up? And that's something that I've passed on to anyone that I mentor, especially someone who, like, comes into Yammer. I'm like, great, here's Yammer, here's how it works. Like, here's about how far you can mess something up. So, like, you're here, and, like, you can go about this far before it gets bad. So, like, this will be fine. And then everyone's like, oh, okay, cool. I'm not, like, just stumbling around in the dark. But then until you have enough experience to, like, bootstrap that confidence, look for other people's experience and confidence and try and, like, piggyback off of their failures and what they've learned. The question is, did I establish a trust relationship with my boss at first? Yeah, I had the, like, phenomenal experience walking into Yammer with a boss who was, like, on my side. I wrote a whole article about how great he was. It was just the best ever. It's called How to Be a Killer Manager and How I Know I Have the Best One. And I kind of detail, like, how, like, that trust relationship was pivotal in my success. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you have any experience with whole product launch and how that might differ from feature releases in terms of the A/B process.
Yeah. I can point you to another talk that was given at Product School New York tonight by a friend of mine on the difference between doing a whole product launch versus doing iterations. So I'm sure that that'll be recorded and on the YouTube channel. I have not had as much experience with that. I was at Asana while they did the big relaunch, which was, it's different. It's much more about, like, setting the stage with the press and, like, making sure you get, like, enough energy towards something, which is kind of the opposite of what you want to do when you want to A/B test, because you kind of want to, like, hush everything and get good pure data. So I'd say that's, like, the main difference from my experience there, but you'd probably want to look to someone who's done more launches. Most of the stuff that I've done is optimization based work. Yeah. Hi.
You said that your role specifically, you guys call hypothesis driven tests. Are there other forms?
Are there other forms of testing than hypothesis-driven testing? I've never worked in an environment that didn't. I think a lot of times people assume that you build an experiment and then you look at the data and then you learn something. And there's that pre-work of establishing what you plan to learn before you build the experiment, and then you look at the data and see, did you learn it? Was it true or was it not? So it drives for a really pure hypothesis and a pure product development process. And it also helps you make really effective trade-offs around, is this necessary in order to learn the thing we want to learn or not? Which is one of the most helpful things about it. I haven't worked in an environment that's like, I guess Asana was more intuition driven than hypothesis and testing driven. But if you're going to do an A-B test, you really want to have a really solid hypothesis before you kick one off. And I think a lot of times people just don't think about that. Yeah.
Are you ever able to monitor like voluntary comments that come in while the study is running? And the limit of influences that we see voluntary to make an influence. So things people setting in voluntary comments help whatever questions coming from customer support as a result of the change in application.
So your question is around people who are volunteering information during a test, and if there's like confusion about it or what do you...
Complaints, inquiries,
yeah.
There's like five things that people generally...
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So we work with user researchers on our team. And so we will frequently be sending out surveys to solicit that. We also will monitor our Twitter feeds and our user voice feeds as well. And so we have like a regular feedback channel. I guess we have App Store reviews, Hockey App reviews, the Twitter, the user voice. We're working on in-product surveys for direct feedback there as well. And every week we have someone on the product team monitoring those channels, and then they send the feedback to the PM who's responsible for the test that's involved in getting that feedback. So we definitely address, like there's been a recent example is I launched a test with a new email, and I got a lot of feedback about people being kind of confused about how to unsubscribe because it wasn't very clear in the settings page, which was totally mind-blowing because we had like a superset setting that for some reason it was a drop-down list. Everyone thought that that drop-down list affected everything below it instead of being its own independent line. So we launched a follow-on project to address that because of the feedback that we got during that experiment.
Have you ever used other tools like Outbrain to test? So you do your qualitative experiments before using other tools that give you metrics, and there are a variety of them out there.
Yeah, so your question is about before we have generated a hypothesis and kick off an A-B test, what do we do before that to establish what we even want to do? Yeah, so again, we have our user research team. They have a whole slew of methodologies, including like heat maps and click tracking and various things. We'll do like bring users in for usability studies or various things. So we do have kind of a constant both exploratory process with them as well as a targeted process when we have some ideas we want to kick around with users. Yeah. Yeah.
When you define a control loop do you ever engineer, like spend a lot of time thinking, okay, I want to test on this loop and I don't want to test on, like, is that common or is it mostly randomization?
Yeah. So the answer is like absolutely never and yes, definitely. So I'll explain what I mean there. So your question was, do you ever engineer who's going to be in the control and who's going to be in the treatment? So definitely never, because you want to actually have a random test group, and that's like the only way you can really trust your data. However, if you are looking to get really undiluted results about something, so let's say there's like a sign-in flow, and then you really want to look at, so then users land on your landing page, and then they can go create a group, and you really want to see, what do people do after they create a group? Well, you could launch a test that enrolled all of your users the moment they land on the landing page into being in the control or the treatment, but then how many of your users are creating groups? Like, that's a super small segment. So then you're going to have like a tiny change there that's going to get crazy diluted by all the users who aren't creating groups, and like your change in how you create groups doesn't matter at all to them. So it's important to make the enrollment event, the event at which you identify whether someone is qualified to send the data into the experiment reporting framework. So you want the enrollment event to be as close to the experience as possible. So we would like enroll users in that case. Once they've created a group, we would enroll them, and then we would like measure how we would like enroll them at that time, and then we'd get 50% of them looking at that freshly created group experience versus 50% looking at the new created group experience. And then we'd measure the difference across those users. And that may be like 1/5 of our total users. So you really want to narrow down to the enrollment event rate at that point. Yes?
Assuming you have sufficient randomization and sample set and all that, can you speak a little bit to the duration of the experiment? Because obviously we can oscillate between significance and insignificance. So
yeah. So the question was, like, assuming you're not hurting for users and you could run a test for as short a period of time as possible, how long should you run a test for? So we have a very, very strong default at Yammer to 2 weeks. And the reason for that is we want to be able to, like, look past the novelty effect. And specifically, we want to look at the 2 week retention mark. So we want to see as users, 1 week is between 1 and 2 weeks. So if you think about the fact that users are coming into this experience the whole time, and you're looking at rolling cohorts, we really want to look at how this affected them a week after they first started experiencing it. And that's like a whole work week. It's a work product. Our analysts have done a lot of work over time to define like what is the appropriate amount of time. And I mean, we could have millions of users enrolled in day one and we'd still look at 2 weeks because we want to look at that long-term effect. Yeah. Three questions. Okay.
The second question is how do you deal with consequences when you need to move from experimental environment to the regular one?
Okay.
And the third, how do you define that you need to conduct experiments taking into account the cost of the experiment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your first question was how good is the code? What's the quality of the code?
Is it production like what are all the testing and stuff like that, or is it something like that? Like dirty code?
Yeah. Yeah, so it depends on if you're planning on shipping that experience. So the webinar that I did with Product School a couple months ago was explicitly about that question, which is how good does this code need to be? And I posited that there's really two answers to that. It should either be like as crappy as it can be, as long as it's not going to affect the results of the test, if you plan to just learn something and throw it away. And we do that sometimes. And it should be as viable as it needs to be in order for you to walk away from it and be comfortable if you plan to ship it if it wins. And we do that. So the question is, from the outset, how much do you plan to ship this if it wins, or how much do you plan to pull this back and that's going to teach you a different thing to go do? So I'll give you an example. We did a test last year where we added a part of the group creation flow that asked for what type of group you wanted this to be. And so people got to pick like, oh, this is going to be like a work group. This is going to be a social group. This is going to be a project group, things like that. And we were never going to build out those types of groups necessarily. We wanted to see if users found that useful, if that would like delay their group building process, how they used the groups after the fact, if they set an intention. And that laid the groundwork for some research investigation and further work that we want to do later based on that hypothesis that we had that it would be useful. So that we never, ever intended to ship that code. So it was pretty crappy. It just didn't like stood up just enough to be able to test. And then we took it down as soon as the test was over. And then your second question was about... So how do we roll users back to the control experience if they... Yeah, if it lost or something like that. Yeah, so we don't allow users to opt themselves into a version of the product. So if the experience won, if we think that it's better for users, then we move all users into that experience. And if the experience lost and we think it's worse for users, we turn it off and we roll them back into that. So we do a lot of change management. We let admins know in advance when we're going to like turn something off and things like that, but we don't really give users the option. No, we have so many tests running. We would never like be emailing them with updates on what's going on. No. Yeah. How do you decide that it's worth it, given that it does cost so much? It depends on who's running the experiment and who's driving that feature and if they have like the inclination toward that. So we have certain people who have like a default, you should definitely test it unless there's a really strong reason not to. And we have other people who are like, you should maybe test it, but like you should think about if there's a good reason to test it. So it really depends on like a lot of the inclination, but we have a really strong testing and learning culture at the company where every month we have share outs about like what tests have wrapped and what we've learned and what the metrics were that then ripple through the rest of the product org. And then we come up with new hypotheses from gathering between different tests and like things that they're doing in onboarding affect me that I'm doing growth and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So the question was about multivariate A/B tests and what are my thoughts on that? I've done a few of those. I tend to avoid them because they. So a multivariate test is when you have just multiple variants. Super straightforward. So I tend to avoid them because it's less clean in terms of our experimenting framework. Like we've just set ourselves up to do straight A/B tests. I think if we had built our product internally, we have internal product that we use. If we had built it to randomize really well across multivariate and to be able to like handle changing proportions or things like that, it'd be different. It's also it's really nice to just like get a whole bunch of users. Like anytime you add another variant, you're reducing the number of users in each cohort. I feel less good about that. I want to get as much confidence as I can that that's a real thing. Yeah.
You're using statistical variation. You have to be really careful on the construct, but it can mm-hmm. really be really efficient in really getting through, like you said, caution with confident multivariate testing.
Yeah, no, we don't go that. No, we're definitely like much more about like, let's build a new feature and let's like get it in front of users. And we're not at the point where I imagine that we might do that for something like a marketing page where you can like, you kind of know where you're going to end up and you know where you're going to start and you want to find like the absolute best there. But when you're talking about changing user flows and user experience, it gets like there's a whole bunch of knobs and levers. So we don't do tests like that. Yeah. Yeah. So your question is, how is it regarded?
Yes.
Yeah. And do you mean internally? Like, yeah, yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure exactly what metric to use to define how it's regarded. I would say product managers are responsible for product development. So, like, the buck stops there.
I mean, do you guys run the product primarily direction? Like, what's the direction?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, like, where does the direction, like, where... So, okay, so I'll say this then. If someone in the company has an idea for a new feature, it goes through a product manager before we decide if we're going to do it or not. So that feature idea will bubble up to the most relevant product manager in whatever space that feature idea came from, an engineer or a marketer or something like that. It will like route through to a product manager who's kind of thinking about that space, and then that PM will decide, should we do it, should we not, does it fit in the roadmap, does it not. So in terms of how it's regarded, I mean, I guess I would say we determine what happens. That's like a weird kind of authoritative stance to take, but it's funny. Everyone always talks about like really flat organizations and like can like everyone giving input and all that. And it's just like it can turn into such a cluster if you don't have like a person who's responsible for making a decision. Like that's just, you don't want consensus. It's the worst possible thing imaginable. So yeah, the product managers make the decisions. And then your follow-on question was around getting a role at Yammer. Yeah. So there's a lot written about this on Medium and other sources. So my experience getting a job at product management at Yammer was I came from Asana, and there's a PM at Asana that had worked with my manager at Yammer, and we got coffee, and that all turned into the beginning of that conversation. Our process is very much a, homework. Yeah, like we have a product homework. It's a very product exercise driven process. And so we're definitely like, I've never once looked at a resume of someone who applied to Yammer, like not even a single time. I think our recruiter will do that and like do some minor screening and things like that. But then we have a product challenge, which is to like a take home assignment that susses out like how people think about product and how they think about testing and how they think about hypotheses. And then depending on like that is the resume. That's the only thing that we look at to determine to interview someone or not. Yeah. What was the appeal about the role? Yeah. So the question was about like my background coming from not tech into tech, and then why and how that went and all that. So I was working in the art market in New York, which is a really fascinating world that's built on the obfuscation of data. And like at all costs, don't let anyone know like that you know how to buy this piece and how to sell it, because that's how you literally make your money. So it's a beautiful world, but it's a backward world. And it's a world where people don't value growth and learning because that's kind of puts the industry at risk. So I was there for a few years and I enjoyed very greatly where I was in the immediate realm, but I realized that like the growth opportunities in the industry were incredibly limited because the industry itself was like the opposite of a growth industry. So I started looking around for what would be an industry where growth was valued and where growth was inherent. And obviously tech is growing much faster than any individual could ever keep up with. So I realized that I wanted to be in tech. I couldn't quite, it took me another few months to figure it out that I didn't want to be a developer. I didn't want to be a designer. Like I had like a bit of a fine art background. So I thought maybe that, I like thinking about algorithms. Maybe I'd go into development. And I didn't even know about product management at the time, but I just got a bunch of coffees with people. And then I found out about product management through a coffee with a PM. And I was like, that's what I want to do. So I spent about the next year and a half working at, like, I tried to start a startup, which just failed miserably. And then I tried to join a friend's startup, which also was horrible. And then I was like kind of teaching these classes that were like terrifying. And then I joined this other startup that like also bombed. But like each time it was like slowly, like slightly bigger, and I was doing like slightly more producty things. And then I managed to start working at Asana, and kind of it's phenomenal. Like, the one thing I'll say is that I applied to probably 60 or 70 roles before I got like an interview, right? So it's just tenacity. Tenacity and just like keep working on things in the meanwhile. Yeah.
So when your tests inevitably fail, how do you convince yourself and your bosses that it's worth
it? Oh, God. That it's. So I think that the hardest thing about a failing test is like your own emotional internal state and like letting go of this thing that you've created out of like will and energy into the world, and then you gotta kill it. So that's hard. It's ever so slightly harder to convince your designers to kill their baby, and then that's okay. So I find actually killing something is a lot harder than shipping it. And the Yammer expectation is that we'll ship about half of the tests that we run. So about half of the time we should fail. And if that's not the case, then we're not trying things that are big enough, that are audacious enough, that are risky enough. And we should just build the things. Why are we testing them? Yeah, so that's always a really, I mean, I've definitely suffered from this, like, oh, but it's like, it's really good. And like, it looks like some things are good, but the whole thing we were trying to build it for did not change and it didn't move. And even though like this particular experience is nice and people are responding to it well, and there's like tons of positive feedback and like locally it's performing really well, it was supposed to make this other thing change and it didn't. So it's just code complexity. So that's terrifying, but true. In the back. Yeah, so the 0.2 p-value is where a lot of the industry will start looking. We tend to start look at 0.15. It's like that's more in the Yammer acceptable range. And even there, we're kind of like, so like directionally, like it kind of looks like this. But in that case, we're usually looking at several different metrics that are very similar, and we would expect them to be correlated. And if they all move with that p-value around there, then we can say, okay, we'll like tie that together. We do see p-values of 0 and p-values of like 0.0001 and things like that. But we won't even consider stuff until it starts like dipping down towards that. So we don't stop. So there's this thing called p-hacking, which is where you just like look at the experiment and see what the p-values look like, and then like keep it running and then look at it again and see what they look like, and then like keep it running until you find a slice where it's like, oh, p-values look good. Like right now, like that's great. So we don't do that. So it's one of the reasons why we default to a preset time frame at which we'll look at the results and determine if we, and so we have like tons of users and we're looking at them at like a predetermined moment in time. So we'll consider directionally if things look in that way, but like our core metrics, we'll usually define like what p-value we'd accept for that metric. Yeah, it's interesting. So the thing is, the smaller the metric moves, the bigger the p-value, and like the harder it'll be to determine if that actually happened or if it was chance, right? So if we ever launch something and it's like a 5% lift in a core metric, which by the way is gigantic, our p-values are going to be zeros because that stuff doesn't happen by chance, right? So we'll only see like the larger p-values and like the random tangential, like easier and more fluctuating metrics. So we don't, like our core metrics tend to like have much smaller moves and much smaller, like if they move, it's a pretty small p-value. Okay, we've got a bunch of questions. You had your hand up a while ago.
Thank you. For me, A/B testing is so boring. It's the most fun part of your job.
Ooh, so you think
how you motivate yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. So your statement is that A/B testing is boring from your perspective. Do you just want to blow your brains out? But what is it from my perspective? Like, what is interesting and what do I love most about the job? The thing that I love most about product management at Yammer is that I've got like 8 different projects right now, and there's like tons of engineers who are like working on these like really deep problems, and I'm kind of like, what is the problem? How can I like help make it less ambiguous and like clear the way for you to move faster? And then like come over here and like, what is the problem? How can I make it less ambiguous and help you move faster? And so I'm involved in like so many things. It's just, it's absolutely titillating. Like there's just so much energy and like drive there that like, if I didn't do that, I would have teams waiting for me and like people would be blocked by me. And that happens when I get overloaded for sure. Mm-hmm. Because I have like 8 different teams that are waiting for me and like looking to me to like make calls and make answers. And it's difficult because there aren't right answers. Like you're going to, anytime you make a call, it's going to be a trade-off and someone's going to be a little bit unhappy on one side or the other. Mm-hmm. Those are the calls that you make, right? Those are the ones that float up to you are the ones that are kind of ambiguous. Because if it was easy and if it was obvious, the engineer would just make the decision and move forward and tell you, hey, this is the thing we're doing. But if it's tricky and if there's a trade-off and it's complicated, then that bubbles up and it's your job to like weigh all the inputs and like weigh what is this going to do to the morale of the tech team if we like incur this debt? And what is it going to do to our user's perception of our product if we like build this thing in this really crappy way? And like, how do we balance between those, right? And like, how do we get things out? So being able to think about like all the different stakeholders and try and make a call that's best across all of them, mm-hmm. is really challenging, but it's really fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
One last question. Okay, who's it gonna be? Oh, terrifying. You have, okay.
Yeah, I have a question. So you mentioned a little bit about the little minima and making incremental changes to the test. So how do you know if you need to rehaul the experience versus keep making those incremental changes to improve the depth?
So your question is if we have an experience and we can just like keep fiddling with it and like getting towards our local optima versus like rehauling the experience, like how do we know? Yeah. I wish I had like a really pithy thing that would like be helpful. I think by the time you're making that decision, there are so many stakeholders involved that there's no easy answer, right? So like by the time, we redesigned our private messaging experience. We had like a real-time chat flow, and then we turned that into like a less synchronous, longer-term communication platform. And that was probably a 2 years in the making decision to like move. And then it was months of iteration exploration in terms of like design research around what should be the next thing. And those decisions, like there's so many stakeholders in the org that are involved. You have so many users that are like invested in the thing that's already being used. That's unsetting that is very difficult. Those decisions, they never happen at the time that it's to make them, right? They always happen after the fact when it's really painfully obvious that you have to. Yeah. Thank you all so much. I appreciate your time and attention.